Brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry, this is the Chemistry World Podcast.
This month, a new technology that's set to give sniffer dogs a run for their money.
So we routinely are detecting vapours at a few parts per billion concentration. I think that this sort of approach is probably the closest thing that anyone has got yet to the sensitivity of a dog's nose.
That's ENO's pioneer Graham Turnbull, who joins us shortly to introduce his plastic semiconductor sensors. Plus, bug-detecting tooth tattoos, and why bacon goes that beautiful iridescent green colour in the fridge. Hello, I'm Chris Smith, and with me for this May 2012 episode of Chemistry World are Laura Howells, Bibiana Campaseo, and Patrick Walter.
The Chemistry World Podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.
And up first, the latest fashion must-have, a biometric temporary tattoo. Laura.
John Rogers at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. Last year, he published a science paper where he was demonstrating this work for the first time. This is a temporary tattoo that can measure various things like your skin hydration.
How do they actually work, these tattoos? What do they do? What are they made of?
They're actually made of silicon components, but they're very, very thin. Once you get down to being very thin, the material properties change. The silicon becomes much more flexible, which is obviously a bonus if you want to be wearing it on your skin. So you have these flexible components wired together with bits of gold, and the way they're connected means that they can bend and flex with your skin, and they can also stretch a bit.
Sure. So there are microprocessors quite literally in contact with the skin, yeah. So you can do things like stretch and, as you say, hydration measures, things like that. How do you get the energy in, though?
So obviously there's not a battery there at the moment. That's one of the things that I think perhaps they'll be looking at in the future. But at the moment, there's what they call a RF tag or a radio frequency tag. So that's just a coil that will pick up radio waves and use that as an induction to power it. And that's also how you can then get the information back off in a wireless fashion.
And what have they done with it so far? Because obviously there was the science paper, that was the proof of concept, yeah. You mentioned that. What's the latest development here?
So the reason why we're talking about this now is I'm recently back from the American Chemical Society's meeting, which was in San Diego, and that's where I met John and actually saw these things. He was actually wearing them on his skin and showing how they were working. They are now sort of teaming up with people, and they actually put it on a NASCAR driver. So there's this driver called Paulie Haraka. So they're putting it on him to measure, yeah, his hydration, his temperature, how his body's sort of moving and responding while he's actually going around the race.
And beyond NASCAR, what other applications might there be? Because, I mean, not everyone can be a NASCAR.
NASCAR is a bit niche, perhaps, yeah. John Rogers was also saying that he's teaming up with a certain sportswear brand to look at the hydration levels of athletes. He wants to look at using it for measuring your skin hydration if you're looking at cosmetics. It's a much easier way of, you know, poking skin when you're trying out different face creams. And slightly further on in the future, he was saying that he's actually put one on his neck and used the muscles in his neck to control a computer game.
So there's sort of accessibility, helping disabled people type spin-offs in this too.
Precisely. So you're looking at maybe controlling prosthetic limbs and things like that.
Well, from one kind of tattoo to another, that is one actually you can really get your teeth into. This is a tattoo from graphene that goes onto teeth, Bibi.
Yes. Basically, this tattoos have got three components. One is graphene, the other one is a bifunctional peptide, and then also we have an RFID device as well. So basically what happens is that these chemical-based sensors are able to tell the researchers when bacteria are in contact with the teeth.
How does the graphene actually work? Is that the bit that's doing the processing? Are these sort of graphene transistors, or is the graphene the thing that's actually doing the detection of the substrate or whatever it is they're measuring?
The first step in this process is printing the graphene grid onto a thin layer of silk. Then the silk is used as a transfer onto the tooth, and actually because of the properties of graphene, the van der Waals forces may mean that it adheres very strongly to the surface. Then on top of that, they add the bifunctional peptides. And basically here, one of the ends is very rich in aromatic residues and therefore it sticks to the graphene. The other one is contains an antimicrobial protein, which actually has a strong affinity for the bacterial strains that they are trying to detect. So what happens then is that when the bacteria bind the antimicrobial protein, there are very small changes in charge on the cell membranes of the bacteria, which the graphene picks up as a change in conductivity, and then this is wirelessly transferred onto an external detector.
So this would literally be stuck onto all your teeth, one of your teeth, some of your teeth?
Probably,
how is this being used?
Probably just one tooth, but it can also be deployed onto soft tissues as well. And it's the first time that this that a device like this has been interfaced with biological tissue. At the moment, it's a proof of concept as well, because they haven't really looked into the selectivity of the antimicrobial protein. So it's not ideal at the moment. But also they haven't looked at how well these devices will stand up to abrasions.
So cleaning your teeth, for example, is the obvious one, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah, it's quite likely that once you brush your teeth, your device will be gone.
How do they see this being used, though? Is the idea that you have a sort of salmonella sensor, so that if you take a bite from a dodgy kebab or a dodgy hamburger and you sort of know not to swallow or something,
spit it out.
Is that the idea?
Yeah, when the alarm bells go off somewhere. I don't know, but I think that could be potentially one of the uses in the future. But yeah, at the moment, the selectivity is not there, but it's a good proof of concept.
And Bibi was describing the work of Princeton scientist Michael McAlpine. If you want to look him up and order your own tooth tattoo. Now, sticking with sensors.
My name's Graham Turnbull. I'm a senior lecturer in the School of Physics and Astronomy at the University of St Andrews. So the aim of these sensors is to try to detect very, very low concentration vapors of explosive molecules. Essentially, what we want to do is to try to make an electronic version of a dog's nose.
How sensitive is a sniffer dog? What sort of concentrations are their nasal passages able to pick up?
A sniffer dog's nose is incredibly sensitive. A saturated vapor pressure for TNT is of the order of a few tens of parts per billion in the air. The levels of concentrations that sniffer dogs can detect are orders of magnitude lower than that.
You're doing it via a chemical and physical route. So what's your approach?
Our approach is to use a novel class of plastic materials called conjugated polymers. They're essentially organic semiconductors. They have semiconducting properties like silicon or gallium arsenide, but they also have very simple processing properties of plastics. So these sorts of materials are in use as light-emitting diodes in displays in Samsung mobile phones. They are being widely developed to make flexible printed solar cells on plastic sheets. But we're using the same sorts of materials as a sensor to try to detect these very low concentration levels of nitroaromatic molecules like TNT.
So how are you registering when the molecule of, say, TNT interacts with the plastic semiconductor material? What chemical changes are taking place that you can detect in an objective and quantitative way?
The process that we use is one of light emission, looking at the fluorescence from the polymer, the semiconducting polymer, or looking at laser emission from the material. When we absorb a photon of light in the polymer, then the excited state on the polymer chain will normally re-emit a photon of light at a longer wavelength. If you have a TNT molecule sitting on the chain, then what can happen is that this excited state, instead of the electron falling back down to a ground state and emitting a photon of light, the electron will transfer onto the TNT molecule and thereby relax back down to the ground state without the emission of light.
It effectively quenches out the fluorescence then, doesn't it?
Yes, so if we have fluorescence present, then it means there's no explosive vapours. If the explosive vapours are present, then the fluorescence switches off.
And how do you make it specific for TNT so that you don't go around detecting potential bombers and people with ordnance amongst a whole bunch of individuals who are completely innocent?
Our mechanism is not a very specific one. It essentially can detect any strongly electronegative material, so materials that have energy levels relative to the polymer that will tend to allow this electron transfer to be favoured. So essentially what it will do is it will detect any nitroaromatic molecules like TNT. But that's fine in the correct circumstance. If you're standing on a minefield and if you find any strongly electronegative molecule, then you have a reason to feel concerned.
We started this conversation discussing the sensitivity of a dog's nose, for example. So compared with a dog, how good are you with your plastic semiconductors? What sorts of concentrations can you detect?
So we routinely are detecting vapours at a few parts per billion concentration. We and other people have shown that you can go to much lower concentrations. I think that this sort of approach is probably the closest thing that anyone has got yet to the sensitivity of a dog's nose, though that still is the most sensitive approach. But the thing about dogs is that if you're going to use a sniffer dog to sniff for explosives, you have to keep them interested. They're playing a game where they sniff for the explosives, and when they find something, they get a reward. But if you want to do a long and highly repetitive survey, like, for example, sniffing every suitcase down a conveyor belt at Heathrow Airport, then the dog gets bored. And there'd be an advantage in having a high-tech approach to detecting the explosives that can deal with these long, repetitive surveys.
I guess part of my question as well was probing, or intended to probe, the idea of practicality. Dogs are good because they're mobile, and yes, you do have to keep rewarding them, but they're relatively easy to train and you can deploy them where the bags are. How easy is it to deploy your system, and how likely is it to be able to pick up a whiff of explosives as a bag goes under an array of, say, your sensors?
At the moment, our research is very much at a stage of a laboratory-based proof of concept, but we're aiming to develop this into a more practical system within a European-funded project focused on the area of humanitarian demining, essentially looking for minefields, the presence of minefields, and looking for individual landmines. And so within that, we aim to develop a small box that's portable, can be mounted on a robot vehicle to essentially make the dog's nose for a robot dog that can travel around a suspected minefield.
And I think probably the most important thing with any sort of new emerging technology, what about the cost? Is this going to be cost-effective and scalable on the sort of level that the anticipated demand? I mean, there's over 100 million landmines out there across the world. Can you meet that challenge in a cost-effective way?
One of the advantages of organic semiconductors is that they're very amenable to low-cost processing. And so people are looking at various printing techniques for making organic LEDs, organic solar cells, organic transistors and electronic circuits. And so in principle, you can mass manufacture at relatively low cost. And so we would hope that this sort of sensor would be amenable to that as well.
St Andrews scientist Graham Turnbull. When you stick a balloon to a wall by rubbing it on your hair, the dogma goes that you're moving charges onto it. Not true, a new study says. Patrick.
Things are always a bit more complex than we're often told at school. So static charge has been something that's been confusing chemists for some time. So chemists have been trying to build up a triboelectric series so you can place the materials in different places according to how positive and negative they are when they're rubbed.
So balloon on hair would be somewhere on a series, amber rod with silk handkerchief somewhere else on the series, and so on. All these different things that you can rub together and you get a charge differential happening.
Exactly. I mean, there's a lot of work in the literature that's gone towards trying to solve some of these problems about where things should come in the series, but there's been completely conflicting results where one group said it's over more towards the positive side, one group said this material is actually charges a bit more negative. It's opening a whole can of worms here, perhaps. Bartosz Grabowski at Northwestern University in the US thinks he's come up with part of the solution to actually creating a triboelectric series where you can actually place these materials.
What have they done? How have they done it?
So what Grabowski did was he was thinking back over some previous work that he did with George Whiteside, I think it's about a decade ago, and they found that there was some kind of material transfer between surfaces when you rub them together.
So physically bits of one thing are going from one surface to the other. So when you rub the balloon on your hair, there's bits of hair or bits of balloon going in one direction or the other between the two surfaces, and that's carrying the charge.
That's it, exactly, yeah.
So how the hell did they prove that?
Right, so what they did was they took some Teflon beads and some polystyrene beads, and when you rub them to start, the Teflon normally charges as negative and the polystyrene charges as positive. But after you've been rubbing them for a while, what actually happens is the polarity reverses. So the Teflon now, instead of being negative, is positive, and it's the same for the polystyrene, it's changed.
So this whole idea of electrons falling off of one and accumulating preferentially on the other can't be right then. Something else must have been going on.
Exactly. So, I mean, using atomic force microscopy, they're able to create a topological map of the particles, and they could actually watch them at the start, and they could watch them after a bit of rubbing, and then after a bit more. And as they did that, they could actually see that bits of the material are rubbing off. I mean, it's not a lot. After about half an hour of the Teflon and the polystyrene beads rubbing, only as much as 5 micrograms per square centimetre transferred from one bead to the other.
But in terms of matter, that's still a lot. I mean, that's a lot of electrons.
Yeah. The thing about static charge is, when people have looked into it, it's not about the properties of the bulk material, it's about the surface. So the surface is where it's all going on, and that's what's happening here. The surface is being transferred from one particle to the other, and vice versa.
Does this mean we now do genuinely have this series, where you can say we know when you rub this with this, this much stuff, and therefore this much charge, is going to transit between the two surfaces, and this should be the ultimate charge?
So yes, it certainly looks like they could start building a triboelectric series by looking at the hardness and softness of the particles. So the harder your particle is, the less likely it is that something will fall off that particle. And this is how you could begin to build up a series.
Why would a series like that be useful?
So static charge is obviously very important for a lot of things. Delicate electronics, for instance. Static charge can be very damaging. So knowing quite what's going to happen when you combine certain materials would be very important.
Well, to something totally different, but it does accumulate, I suppose, in one sense, Bibi, and that's bacon accumulates a green colour. I've got some in my fridge which is labelled definitely for the dog. It really is. So what is this green colour, and what have scientists learned about it recently?
Yeah, this is not a very glamorous story at all. But yeah, there has been some work done on green bacon, or the iridescence that you can see on the surface of bacon. And the team that did it at Bayes at University of Oklahoma in the US, and the lead researcher is George Richter Addo. So basically, well, we all have seen green bacon. A chemical that has been used for centuries to preserve meat is nitrite. So what these guys have discovered is that it actually reacts with myoglobin on the surface of the bacon to produce the green pigment that you see.
The myoglobin being the iron-containing pigment, which is a bit like hemoglobin, but in muscle, and it gets oxygen off of hemoglobin in blood and puts it into the muscle cells.
Absolutely, that very same one. What happens here is that people are a little bit concerned that they don't know what the effect of nitrite, the preserver that we're talking about, or nitrite burn, which is the term that has been used to describe this iridescence in the body, does it have any health implications? So this group of researchers have decided to actually fully characterize the structure of nitrite burn using X-ray diffraction. And this is the very first step towards discovering how or whether it would react with myoglobin or hemoglobin in the body.
So you take basically the molecule that you get that's the green color, do X-ray investigations on it. What do they find?
They basically found that the nitration occurs at the 2-vinyl group of the macrocycle rather than the 4-vinyl group, and this is attributed to aesthetic factors. So I wouldn't say that it's a huge discovery, but it actually helps them understand how nitrite burn is formed, potentially would help understand how it is going to behave when once it enters the body.
So going back to my point, can I eat green bacon?
Yes.
Safely. I should add safely on the end. What would be the implication then off the back of this piece of work?
Well, the next study that they have to do is around whether this nitrite burn affects the physiological function of myoglobin. We know that there is very little change to the overall configuration of the macrocycle, but they need to look at the physiological function, and then we should be able to know whether we are okay with the green bacon or not.
In the meantime, I do what I do and give it to the dog. You're listening to Chemistry World with me, Chris Smith. Still to come, why nanoparticles are worse for young lungs, and 50 years of the LCD screen. But first, to artificial life. Biology has had a crack at creating life. Now it's the turn of chemistry. Lee Cronin.
Right now, biology's abuzz with the term synthetic biology, where people are playing around with the current infrastructure of biology, the nuts and bolts, proteins and DNA and regulatory mechanisms. But I want to get below that and ask a question: where did that biology come from, and what was the chemistry set that we used to start that biology off?
Because there was enormous fanfare when Craig Venter a couple of years ago created what he called synthetic life, but the reality was, although they re-edited a genome from scratch, they still had to bung it into another cell, a bacterial cell, to then kickstart life in that bacterial cell. And that left the outstanding question, well, where did the cell come from in the first place?
Exactly. Now, what Craig did was amazing, but all he did do was basically take, I don't know, a BMW and a Mini and take the engine from one and the bits and bunged it in the other. He didn't make a new engine. Well, he did make the engine, but he already had the blueprints. And I think that we're asking something fundamentally much more important, which is how do we actually rewrite those blueprints, and what is the feature for? What features do living systems have that are defined in those blueprints?
Indeed. Well, first of all, let's take a look at what it is you're trying to do, because there's a number of problems which frustrate scientists who are trying to recreate life, not least actually how you get something which is this miniature reacting vessel, a cell. So how are you tackling that?
One of the things that people are trying to do right now is divide up the properties of a cell. So the cell is a container. It contains some information. It contains a database, and it contains a synthetic machinery that makes proteins, and it contains metabolism. And so what people are trying to do right now is de-engineer that in such a way that they come up with chemical analogies that aren't biology. So they're trying to use more basic lipids, a more basic database, and a more basic metabolism. And the problem is they're trying to put them together, but it's rather like when Frankenstein was assembling, it's trying to get that spark of life back into the dead parts. They look like they should talk to each other, but despite current efforts, it's very difficult to boot that system.
Are we slightly thinking inside the box, or inside the constraints of the existing cell, if you will, in the sense that we're all looking for a way to make something which biology already has? Should we not think differently and think, well, do we have to be constrained by the present chemical and structural architecture of a cell? Is there an alternative we could use instead?
Oh, yeah, well, there's not just an alternative cellular architecture. There's probably a whole alternative elemental architecture. But to do that, first of all, one needs to think about what properties you're trying to give your chemical system. And so my thesis here, my coming into this is to say, well, right now on planet Earth, what is the minimal chemical building block or chemical unit that can exhibit Darwinian evolution? And when you think about that question in that way, you come up with an obvious but yet profound answer, and that's a very simple cell, a bacterial cell, amoeba, or something of that ilk.
So biology's got about a 3.9 billion year head start over you. Do you think, though, that you'll end up at the same position biology is and just reinvent the wheel, or is there a genuinely better way of doing this, or a way which is distinct, which has advantages for chemistry and will be unconstrained by the requirements of biology?
It would be fair to say that biology on planet Earth is really a product of the available chemistry. And so if we're to use a different chemistry set, then we are going to get some common features, hopefully, you know, if we're aiming for Darwinian evolution, but we might get some very different strategies used by the system to establish that evolutionary dynamic. So it may get energy in different ways. There might be different catalysis. There might be slightly different information processing. And I think that that's an incredibly important thing. And reinventing the wheel is really interesting because if we do reinvent the wheel, but using different elements, that'll give us a different genome and a different proteome and a different test bed to look at life as a entity, as a thing.
And if you can get this life to work in a test tube, a chemical life, I can see that if it uses very different building blocks than that which biology does, it will make people very comfortable. But won't you be constrained in terms of what you could do with it if it won't interface chemically and readily with existing systems and biology?
So I would like to take you my cells that we've made in my lab that replicate and look like cells, and I want to take some bacterial cells and then show you them and get you to look at them under a microscope and see if you could tell the difference. And if you couldn't tell the difference, then my cells were as alive as the other ones. But then we'd like to take it one step further and mix those cells together so they could interact with each other. And what some bacterial cells can do is a thing called quorum sensing, where they basically group together and they can produce a concentration of a chemical messenger. And when that messenger gets to a certain concentration, they all light up and change their behavior. Wouldn't it be fantastic if we made an artificial cell that had a completely different artificial biology, yet made the same chemical messengers as like an imposter to interact with other cells so that our cells couldn't tell the difference?
I think it would be absolutely terrific if you could do that. How far have you got down that path, though?
What we have been able to do in my lab is we've been able to make cells made out of metal oxide clusters, and they form basically like a lipid bilayer, and we can fabricate them. And also the clusters, which are quite intricate, complex nanomolecules with a large size and many hundreds of metal atoms in them, have different structural geometries, different types. Within the cell, we can put lots of different clusters which can interchange. And just like proteins, they have different folds and different numbers of units in them. So we've managed to make those, and we've managed to start to set up the dynamics whereby the clusters could compete with each other under a given set of conditions, and only the fittest cluster survives and can be selected. And where we're struggling at the moment is to get the selection to move into a replication, a copying. For Darwinian evolution to occur, you need a copying or a replicative process.
You've put your neck on the block to a certain extent here, because you've actually gone and done a TED talk where you gave yourself 2 years, and that was a year ago almost. Are you going to be able to achieve this? Do you think this is realisable within your self-set and self-imposed time limit?
Actually, yes. We are on the borderline of being able to show autonomous chemical evolution. We were cheating a little bit using computers and flow systems, but we won't be cheating as much as, say, Craig Venter did by using an existing biology. So will we be able to make entities that can evolve and get fitter within the next couple of years? It may not be within my strict 2-year timeline. It may be maybe slightly longer, 3 years and so on, because doing it is one thing, but getting it through peer review may take a little bit extra time. So hopefully we will certainly have done it, or be publishing a paper that shows the first small step in that direction within the next 2 years. I'm pretty confident.
Glasgow University's Lee Cronin. And now to nanoparticles. Laura.
So this is about children's lungs, and more particularly how infant lungs are particularly prone to nanoparticle deposition from medicines, for inhaled medicines, but also obviously for pollutants and things in the environment.
So when you say they're particularly vulnerable, does that mean from the minute of birth, or does this change as they age?
The lungs are a really complicated structure, and right at the end are these alveoli. So these are small sacs, but you're not born with these. These sort of grow and develop within the first sort of 2 years of your life. And it's the alveolar shape that's important in what they call chaotic mixing of gases in your lungs. So if you just sort of breathed in and air sort of got up to the surface, there's already air in your lungs, there wouldn't be this mixing. You'd not actually absorb very much oxygen. So the shape of the alveoli actually encourages mixing of the gases that remain in your lungs with the new air that you're breathing in. But of course, this mixing also means that nanoparticles that you're breathing in can get up to the surface of your lungs and irritate them or be absorbed by them.
So are you saying that as a child's lungs develop, as it grows over the first couple of years of its life, this mixing phenomenon becomes more pronounced?
Exactly.
And that drives greater potential deposition of any inhaled nanoparticles?
Yeah. At about the time when the alveoli start developing or properly make this shape, which is about the 1.5, 2 year mark, that's when you really get this change to get this absorption of nanoparticles.
And does it remain that way into adulthood?
It remains the same, because once you're an adult, you also have these same sacs. The difference, of course, is that once you're bigger, the alveoli are bigger, and therefore the actual surface area to volume ratio is different. So what you end up with is this sort of, I'd say it was sweet spot in a way. There's a point where you've got the shape, so you've got this mixing going on, but at the same time, the alveoli are very small, which means that there's a much larger surface area. And so that's what we're saying by children's lungs are so, particularly at this 1.5, 2 year old.
So there's
mark.
Low vulnerability, period of higher vulnerability, and then more growth kicks in, and the vulnerability drops
exactly
away.
Exactly, and it becomes less of an issue.
Who's done this, and how have they reached this conclusion?
OK, so this is work by Akira Tsuda at the Harvard School of Public Health in the US, and he actually came up with the idea of this chaotic mixing in the alveoli, the way that the shapes of the alveoli actually cause the air to mix in a particular way. He came up with that in about 1995, but he's been thinking, what does this mean for children? I mean, as the lungs develop, how does this change? So he did some modelling, computer modelling, and had a look and saw that it really was this, it seemed to be this development of the shape that was very important. So he then spoke to some colleagues in Germany, Wolfgang Grayling. He took Suda's model and practiced it in rats. And what they've shown was that at 3 weeks in rats, which is equivalent to the sort of the 1.5, 2 year period that I was discussing, it really does seem like there is a definite susceptibility.
Laura, thank you very much. Something completely different is a compound that I've never heard of, largely because it hadn't existed before, Patrick, germinone.
Right, so ketones, you can find them everywhere in carbon-based compounds, in organic compounds, in all sorts of things in your body, like hormones, like cholesterol. And you'll find them in things that you eat, in food, you'll find them in trees, they're everywhere. These are incredibly ubiquitous bonds.
It's basically a carbon with a double bond to an oxygen.
Exactly.
In the middle of a carbon chain.
That's right. So carbon's in group 14, and people have been wanting to investigate other double bond oxygen molecules within group 14. So this is things like germanium, things like silicon. And for a while, people thought they had actually developed a silicon with a double oxygen bond. Silicone's the material you find in things like breast implants, industrial lubricant. But what they developed wasn't actually a silicone. It was a polysiloxane, so which is actually silicon, oxygen, silicon in a kind of long polymer chain style.
So why are they difficult to make? What's special about carbon, which means it will do this, but other things in that same group, which should do it, are hard to do it with?
Carbon is a bit easier to create these, well, it's a lot easier to create these ketones because the difference in electronegativity between the carbon and the oxygen is much lower than some of those heavier elements as you go down the group. To get around this and to actually try and create these double bonds with heavier elements in group 14, Kohei Tamao and Tsukasa Matsui at the Riken Advanced Institute in Japan, they attached it to iron, this really bulky ligand, and they attached two of these ligands to the germanium.
What do they actually do to the germanium?
So these ligands are kind of stabilising molecules. So when you react the germanium with these two iron ligands attached with a trimethylamine oxide, you actually get the germanium-oxygen double bond, and this is stabilised by these ligands. It stops it flying apart, basically, so it holds it in place. I mean, basically what they've done here is take this germanium, this germinone, and see how it reacts. And this is a technique that could be applied to any of the group 14 elements. In fact, it can be applied to other elements in the periodic table. So you can take it in all sorts of directions.
So, Patrick, stay there, because what about this month's trivia? What have you got in line for us?
OK, so I don't know if you remember from your childhood a cartoon called The Jetsons. So the Jetsons was a cartoon created by the inventors of the Flintstones. And
now that's something I have heard of. Yeah. Okay.
Everyone remembers the Flintstones. But 50 years ago, the Jetsons came out, and this gave us a window into a futuristic world where spaceships flew through the air, folded up into suitcases, and everyone had screens on their walls that were incredibly thin.
So it's a sort of precursor to the LCD or plasma, is that what you're saying?
And that's exactly where we're going. So 50 years ago was also when the first sort of putative, the first potential LCD screen was created. So up until then, liquid crystals were considered a bit of an oddity. I mean, they were first discovered in 1888, but no one had done anything with them. So what Richard Williams did when he was working at the Radio Corporation of America was he sandwiched some liquid crystals between two transparent electrodes. And when he applied a current, something happened that he didn't expect. Rather than just getting a change in the absorption spectra of the crystals, what he actually got was a change in the colour. So the crystals actually changed into regular domains, different colours. That was the start of the LCD screen. I mean, he was quite far-sighted, as he did actually put together some patents about this technology being deployed as an electronic screen.
I don't know about flat screens. I always wanted one of those Flintstones cars where your legs stick out underneath. I don't know why. That's it for this month. Thank you to our guests Graham Turnbull and Lee Cronin, and also to the Chemistry World team, Bibiana Campaseo, Patrick Water and Laura Howes. The production was by Mira Senthilingam, and I'm Chris Smith from thenakedscientists.com. Join us for more analysis next time. Until then, goodbye.
The Chemistry World podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.